Hello, everyone, and welcome to this A-State Connections special program. It's COVID-19 questions and answers on KASU. I'm News Director Jonathan Reeves, and for the next hour, I'll be joined by my guest, Dr. Shane Spites. He's the Dean of the NYIT College of Osteopathic Medicine at Arkansas State University. We're going to be talking about COVID-19 and ask some of the key concerns related to the pandemic. And also in the program as we go along, I'll also be asking some questions that listeners previously submitted over Facebook. So let me welcome Dr. Shane Spites. He's joining me over Zoom today. Dr. Spites, thank you so much for your time. Welcome back to KASU. It's always great to have you on, sir.
Well, thank you, Jonathan. I appreciate the opportunity. Always good to speak with you and your audience and try to maybe bring some insight into this crazy time.
Because this is on A-State Connections, you know, we've talked a lot on A-State Connections previously about NYIT and things that have been going on there. This was well before we started talking about COVID-19. So I did want to ask you about the recent graduation ceremony that you had, the first graduating class at NYIT's College of Osteopathic Medicine there. Your thoughts on reaching that milestone of the first graduating class?
Oh, thank you for asking about that, Jonathan. You know, just truly an epic feeling, and truly just an exciting highlight for us in terms of when you think about the journey to just start this medical school when it started as a conversation. You know, just really, you know, 5-6 years ago was the conversation being discussed about having a medical school here in Northeast Arkansas on the Arkansas State University campus. And here we are graduating that first class. We're just so proud of them. They're now going on to their residency programs to get their training in what specialty they're going into. And just as a reminder, you know, and this is the way it works across the country, you spend 4 years in medical school. So you got to get all the pre-work, so to speak, like at ASU where you get some science classes and you can get that background. Then you get into medical school and you're there for 4 years. And then after you graduate, you have to go on and do additional training. You can't go right into practice. So for example, family medicine is an additional 3 years of training, general surgery is 5 years. And so now our students have graduated, 95% of them matched into residencies, which is phenomenal. That national average is about 90%. And you know, our mission from the beginning has been to get physicians in the needed areas of Arkansas and the Delta region in the specialties that are needed there, which is like internal medicine, general pediatrics, and family medicine. And 72% of our students have gone into primary care, with 35% of those specifically going into family medicine. But I mean, we had great students that went into very competitive programs that matched into programs up in Mount Sinai in New York and then over into California. I mean, into orthopedic surgery, neurology, interventional radiology, ophthalmology. So, I mean, we couldn't be happier, Jonathan, of this class, couldn't be prouder of them. You know, we hated, obviously, that it had to be virtual because everybody was just so excited about seeing them back on the campus, being able to shake their hand and give them a hug and tell them how proud we were. But it was still a monumental event just the same.
Do you know if there will be something that will be held in person in the future for that class?
You know, at this point, we are planning. We're planning to have an in-person graduation actually next May. And what that would mean is we would actually hold two graduations. We would hold the graduation for the class of 2021, but we would also hold one with probably within a couple of weeks of each other for the class of 2020. So at this point, it is our plan to go ahead and have an in-person graduation for them next year.
And now with those students that go to the residency programs, how do you all kind of keep in touch with those students and how does that work? Because I know y'all are still following them as they're going through the residency programs.
No, absolutely. So we know which programs they've matched into. So we know where they are all over the country in terms of what programs they'll be attending for the next several years. And they maintain their NYIT email address. So we can stay in touch with them through that mechanism as well.
So I know Arkansas State has been considering options about what to do with the fall semester, trying to get students in class this August. Of course, it's a little bit of a challenge because there's a lot of, you know, what do you do if the COVID-19 hits in the fall? What are you all doing there at the College of Osteopathic Medicine, NYIT, on the campus of Arkansas State to try to prepare for the fall semester, if you don't mind, please?
Yeah, we evaluated several different models out there. As you might imagine, colleges, universities, medical schools all over the country are grappling with this in terms of the big what if, because there's there's a high likelihood we will see a significant return or spike in cases in the fall. We have opted to go with something called the HyFlex model. And basically what that is it's a model that allows you to either increase or shrink your interactions, person-to-person interactions with students and faculty, depending on the given situation. We opted for that because, again, we don't know what to expect. We, you know, maybe cases will drop off at a certain point that will allow us to have, you know, more face-to-face interaction. If cases, you know, go up and it starts becoming a significant issue, we're going to need to back up to more of a virtual platform. And this model allows us to do that. And so what that means for us is starting in August, our students will be here on the campus of Arkansas State University this August. Starting off in some small groups. And what I mean by that is they will come in, like our orientation will be just be small groups of students at one time that would come in and get their orientation, as opposed to the whole 115 or 120 students that we bring in usually in mass. We'll do this in a small group. All of our lectures are going to be pre-recorded, and the students will access them through a virtual platform. Our faculty will hold virtual office hours. Even like our student organizations, they will meet virtually, as well as Student Government Association, class leaders, all of that, those will be virtual. Some of our small groups will be virtual. We'll have a few of them that are in person. As you might imagine, medical school does demand pieces of the curriculum be hands-on. And so some of that is just the nature of the beast, so to speak, and we'll take every precaution we can to keep the faculty and the students and the staff safe during that time period. Ideally, like I said, it's just a smaller group. So rather than bring in, you know, 40 or 50 students into a lab session, maybe it's 8 or 10 to truly limit, if one of those is infected, then to limit the spread. Luckily, and we can talk about this a little later, luckily the age group we're referring to has a lower incidence of complications. They are more likely to be spreaders, but less likely to truly fall significantly ill to the virus.
Now, with that, and you know, you may go run into a situation, and this is where some people are really, really concerned about, if you have like asymptomatic, you know, people that may not know that they have the symptoms and all that. That is one of the things I was going to talk to you about later, but we'll go ahead and talk about that now. What do you do with something like that by way of, you know, there have been some people that have said, well, I tried to get tested, but people said if you didn't have any symptoms, you didn't need to be tested, but you could have been asymptomatic. I know that several student athletes at Arkansas State University this way, they came back on campus. They were tested. They're asymptomatic, but they were tested positive for the virus. How do you deal with something like that?
So that's a quandary, I'll be honest with you. And again, I think universities and colleges across the country are dealing with this. We're looking for some guidance of the CDC and the Arkansas Department of Health in terms of the best mechanism. Ideally, you test everybody, you test them when you can, you test them multiple times, and that would be great. We're not in the situation right now, based on resources, to say that I could test the entire ASU student population every other day, or those in the Northeast Arkansas area or the Jonesboro area. We have a finite amount of tests. Now, we'll say this. It is certainly different than when we started. When we first started testing, it was only really people that ended up in the hospital. So we knew we were missing a lot of them, but it was all, and from a testing standpoint, that was all we had. We've now gotten more testing supplies, more testing ability. And so there's drive-through testing available for really anyone who wants it. And so you can go through and do that. I don't know, and that's what we're kind of crossing our fingers on. I don't know if we'll have capacity by August to be able to do the mass testing that we would like to do, like you're seeing with these student athletes that come back on campus. Can we just mass test students as they come back in? And you bring up a great point. I mean, these individuals, from my understanding, had zero symptoms at all. And so these are, you know, young, healthy individuals that have the virus that are spreading it unknowingly to, the person they're standing next to at Kroger or Walmart or the gas station or wherever it might be, and so that's the concern. And it kind of goes back to, this is why we have said before, look, that's why you should wear masks in public. That's why you should, you know, do the hand washing, you know, the alcohol-based hand sanitizers. You can't just necessarily look at somebody and say they do or do not have COVID. And so that's something we're grappling with. Now, we at NYIT are working with the Arkansas Department of Health. We'll be developing certain specific processes to be utilized on the ASU campus and working closely with ASU, as we always have, to be able to make sure that that the right practices and policies and procedures are followed to ensure the safety of the students, the staff, and the faculty on the campus, because that's what we want at the end of the day.
And I know usually you'll have every year the annual white coat ceremony that's normally held in August. Will you have it at that time, or are you expecting maybe to push it back? Have y'all made a decision on that?
Yeah, we've pushed that back. I'll just say this. Any event that the college would normally do that's going to have large numbers, really over, 50 people or more, we've either postponed or canceled those events. So to your point, the white coat ceremony, at this point, we've pushed that to January. I'll be surprised if we can even do it in January. But that's an event that we typically get right at 1,000 people at, anywhere between 800 to 1,000 people. And it would just be negligent at this point to get that many people into one confined area. And so that, like I said, I'll be surprised if we can pull it off in January. We may have to push it further. Some medical schools actually do the white coat ceremony in between the second and third year, because that's the transition into the clinical years. Actually, our New York campus did that for many years. We chose to do it and kind of moved to doing it as a kind of a passage, rite of passage into medical school. And I still believe that that's the right thing to do. But, you know, these are unprecedented times. And so we have to make changes and adjustments based on that.
You're listening to COVID-19 Questions and Answers. It's an A-State Connections special program. I'm Jonathan Reeves. We'll return with our guest, Dr. Shane Spites. You are listening to KASU, streaming live on KASU.org. Perfect. Thank you so much. We will go to the second segment here. This is COVID-19 Questions and Answers. It's an A-State Connections special presentation. I'm KASU News Director Jonathan Reeves. My guest this hour, Dr. Shane Spites, is the Dean of NYIT College of Osteopathic Medicine at Arkansas State University. Dr. Spites, let's talk about the virus as we enter the summer months now. You expect the virus to spread? Do you think humidity will possibly take a toll on the virus? What are your thoughts on that?
We do expect to continue to see spread of the virus through the summer, and that's what we're seeing now. To your point, it is affected by ultraviolet light. So the sun's rays, sunshine does help. The humidity, the higher temperatures help. For sure. But as we have individuals engaging in events that encourage close proximity, you'll see the virus spread from person to person. And we've seen some of that already in our state and in surrounding states. So I expect kind of some ups and downs. I expect it'll go up and it'll come down. So I expect kind of an oscillating picture this summer right now. I think it'll be a different conversation as we get into the fall.
Do you think we're in the second peak of the virus right now?
When you look at our actual trend lines, when you look at for the state of Arkansas, we've been going kind of up and down and up and down. So we've had several, what I would say, small peaks. We're experiencing right now the largest peak we've had. We're seeing the largest numbers that we've had before this ever started now. And it's June. So it's warmer temperatures than it was when we first started seeing this. And that is, what it boils down to is just, people are reducing their social distancing. And, there's some fatigue that goes on. People are tired of hearing about it. They're tired of hearing me talk about it. They're tired of seeing it on TV. And I get it. I'm tired of it. My family's tired of it too. It doesn't change the fact that it's still here. It doesn't change the fact that it's still being spread around. It doesn't change the fact that it's just looking for the opportunity to jump from person to person. And so if it can do that in the, you know, in the grocery store or in, you know, a restaurant or something like that, that's what'll happen. And so as we reduce our social distancing, you're going to see more viral spread. I do think, though, that because we don't have right now schools and universities that are in session, we're not seeing near the numbers that we expect to see in the fall.
So since we've talked last, I know that there's a lot of information about the virus. Have you learned anything new about this since we've talked last on the COVID-19 questions and answer sessions?
Absolutely, Jonathan. And we continue to learn things almost daily, but certainly, you know, every few days or so, there's going to be new research that comes out. There is just volumes and volumes of data that's being poured through, and research articles and things are being produced for that. And so, you know, just a couple of things for your listeners. One of the things early on, you know, everybody was wiping down their groceries and wiping down everything that they came in contact with. The new data shows that it's actually less likely, not that it can't, but less likely to spread on surfaces. And so that's something that the CDC's put out that should allow for some reassurance in terms of touching surfaces. It can still be spread that way, but that's not the primary way it's spread. Primarily, it's being spread person to person through the air. And there is some evidence that and some researchers are coming out saying that they believe that this is actually an airborne disease. And what I mean by that is it actually hangs out longer in the air. And so that would be important to know. If I cough or if I sneeze out into the air and it hangs out for, you know, even a couple of hours there and somebody walks through and gets infected by that, that would be important. And again, it just underscores the need for the mask wearing out in the public. We feel like that primarily it seems to be migrating through the nose, less likely through the mouth, so more through the nose. In terms of infections, we don't appear to be seeing any significant mutations in the virus right now. That was a concern early on about the significance of a mutation. We don't see any mutations occurring at this time. On the vaccine front, there's been an unprecedented move. We've never seen this before, but they are producing vaccines at the same time they are testing it. I think that's interesting. It's obviously risky from a financial standpoint to produce millions or even a billion vaccines and have no idea whether it works or not. And so that's a gamble that some of these pharmaceutical companies are taking. Antibody tests, good thing to kind of as an update on that. The CDC came out with a stance on that and says that about half the time those antibody tests are wrong. That was a concern that we had early on when everybody was trying to jump on the antibody test. And so about 50% of the time, the results don't seem to be helpful at all. So those are just a couple of hot points there that I think the listeners may be interested in.
Are we jumping all of this so quickly because we're wanting to find, and I hope this doesn't sound like a stupid question, but I'll ask it anyway, because I don't mind asking stupid questions. But is it because that we are, you know, just so scared of the disease or of the virus that we want to go ahead and find something as quick as possible? Or do you think it's because we're just impatient? I mean, we're in a society where it's almost like we're in a drive-through society. We want stuff right now, if you know what I'm trying to ask. And do you think that contributes to some of the rush? It has to be a concern to medical professionals.
John, it's not a stupid question at all. And I think it goes to the heart of some of the issues that we're seeing. And I think it's the latter. I think we're a very impatient society. We're a very much a now and in the moment. I want it now. I want it done now. I want to move on. I want this to be over. That is the way our society is. That's the way our culture is. And that does not work out well during a pandemic where you have to be able to wait. You have to be able to, you know, to be tempered in your responses. You have to be able to be thoughtful. You have to be able to trust, you know, science and research and evidence. And so one of the things that has been so disheartening for me in all of this, certainly as an educator and someone, the leader of an academic medical institution, is the issue that we're seeing about the challenging of, is this really a big deal? Is this, you know, and so that's concerning. That's concerning, you know, from many aspects that people aren't taking this seriously. But yeah, I think you're exactly right. I think people's patience are wearing thin. And they don't want to deal with this anymore. And so, unfortunately, we're going to see increased cases whenever things like that happen.
Gil asked this question, and he's been concerned about if there was a correlation between the flu and COVID-19. Do people have the flu? Because there's a lot of similarities in symptoms, possibly. I don't know if I have the flu. I don't know if I have COVID. Could I have both? Could you address that, if you don't mind, please?
Absolutely. And it could be confusing. It's still confusing. It was certainly confusing early on. We know there are some certain symptoms you don't get with the flu. The loss of taste and the loss of sense of smell is not something you get with influenza. But to his point or to his question, yeah, you can get a fever, you can get a cough, you can get fatigue, you can get muscle aches. And so a lot of those, and it's not, it happens with the flu, but there are other respiratory viruses that trigger that kind of immune response. So that can be confusing. And that's going to be important as we enter into the fall when our flu season picks back up. And that's why we make such a big deal about people getting their flu vaccine. Because right now we don't have a COVID-19 vaccine. But we've got, for the most part, really good flu vaccines. And so people should get their flu vaccine certainly in October. That's the new recommendation. I know early on, I even was a proponent of this early on until the data changed, and then you have to change your stance. It used to be that, take the flu vaccine as soon as it comes out. If it comes out in August or it comes out in July, take the flu vaccine. New data says that you should take that flu vaccine really about the October timeframe. That there is some waning or there's some reduction in terms of effectiveness during the season. And we know now the season can go into February, March, and April. So for your listeners on the flu vaccine, I would be getting that in October. Don't get that right when it comes out in August.
So how do medical providers and healthcare workers prepare for the fall and the winter when you could have both flu and COVID-19 happen at the same time?
So with the biggest thing for us, and luckily on the side of the flu, we've got rapid flu tests. So our rapid flu tests are good. So we feel good about that. We also have flu medications. You've got Tamiflu, Relenza. We've got medications we can use, and we've got the flu vaccine. So those are the three things that we use to combat influenza every year, and we will need those this year more than ever. Those are also three things we do not have for COVID-19. The testing that we have for COVID-19 is still not rapid, and I don't know that it will be by August or by this fall. I would love for it to be the case. I would love for us to be able to have a rapid COVID test available, but I don't know that there will be. So right now we are still with what our traditional testing in, which is a PCR test, which typically the turnaround time is anywhere from 12 hours to 48 hours, depending on the lab and depending on how it's processed. And so that's kind of where we're going to be. So this fall, I do anticipate, certainly we'll be doing lots of testing for flu to make sure that it's not that. And I think there will be a rule out process. And so I think you'll have people being tested for both and being treated. So patient comes in with flu or COVID symptoms, just as an example, they'll be tested for flu. If that flu is negative, they'll also be tested for COVID-19. The COVID-19 results likely won't be back within a day or so. The patient will be told to self-quarantine until the results come back. And so I could see that as a general scenario that would be taken this fall. And again, we'll obviously adhere to ADH and CDC guidance as that comes out in the next month or so.
Dr. Shane Spites is joining me here on A-State Connections on KASU with the COVID-19 questions and answers. Dr. Spites, you recently moderated a panel of medical professionals from around the region that were talking about healthcare and COVID-19. What are healthcare facilities doing right now to reduce the spread of COVID-19? Because people are afraid of going to the doctor. They're afraid that if they go to the doctor, they're going to get sick. And that kind of tell us about that, if you don't mind, please.
I'm glad you brought that up, Jonathan. I'm glad that we're having this discussion. I think one of the unintended consequences that occurred, and some of this obviously driven by fear of I don't want to go to the doctor, I don't want to go to the ER and get sick, is that people have not been going when they needed to. And so what I mean by that is, well, let's just take, for example, on the ER side, ER visits are down about 41-42% nationally. What you don't want is someone who's having chest pain or having signs and symptoms of stroke or having a hypertensive emergency where their high blood pressure is at a critical point that's causing organ damage. You don't want those individuals to wait at home because they're fearful of getting COVID. And the other side of it is people that would normally be scheduled for screening exams, maybe your colonoscopy, your annual mammogram, or, prostate screening. The bigger thing we're seeing as well on the pediatric side is vaccine rates. Here in the state of Arkansas alone, we're seeing right at a 30-33% reduction in vaccinations of our children compared to this time last year. That's extremely concerning. And I've said this during the panel, and I've said this before, I can't imagine what would happen if we see a measles outbreak on top of COVID-19. So certainly want to encourage all your listeners to make sure that they help spread the word, and not the virus, basically, that we want people to get vaccinated. We want people to go see their healthcare providers, to see their physicians, to go to those physician clinics and make those appointments. A lot of physicians' offices now are doing the telemedicine, the telephone visits. I was in clinic yesterday and had two televideo visits that went fine. And they were two patients that did not need to be in my clinic. And so I had those visits over televideo, and it worked out fine. We were able to get, refills and get them taken care of. And so there's ways still to get this done, but the patients shouldn't be overly concerned, because the physicians' offices and the hospitals are doing everything they can to protect them. A lot of these hospitals are screening their staff, as they come in daily or every other day. Obviously, any staff that have symptoms, they're keeping them at home. Most of the hospitals are reducing visitors. And so when you talk about asymptomatic spreaders, that really reduces the chance of that happening within a hospital. And so I think that's good news. So there's a lot of measures being taken to protect patients and those visitors to these facilities.
Yeah, because I would imagine that there is a real health risk, as you mentioned earlier, about if people just wait until the number of cases go down, but they're continuing to go up. It might be that I would think that with that, if you have multiple medical emergencies at once, wouldn't that lead to overwhelming the medical system?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. If you started seeing an increase, a surge at one point, and that would be a concern, is that you would utilize or use up all of your resources at one time. That goes back to the conversation that you and I had several weeks ago on the whole flattening the curve idea. That was the idea behind that in the very beginning, was that we didn't want to overwhelm our healthcare system. We've got a finite number of resources. You only have a certain number of nurses. You only have a certain number of doctors. We only have a certain number of ventilators, or, whatever it may be. And so we want to make sure that everybody that needs them has those resources. And so it's about managing it.
You've been listening to COVID-19 Questions and Answers. I'm Jonathan Reeves. We'll return with our guest, Dr. Shane Spites. You're listening to KASU, streaming live at KASU.org. Also, we encourage you to go to iTunes or Google Play, and you can download the new KASU app. Just search for KASU app. You can take KASU anywhere you go on your mobile device. Back with more after this. All right, we'll do the final segment here, sir.
Okay.
Welcome back to COVID-19 Questions and Answers, an A-State Connections special presentation. We're continuing to ask questions with Dean of the NYIT College of Osteopathic Medicine at Arkansas State University, Dr. Shane Spites. I'm News Director Jonathan Reeves. As we continue on talking about this, your thoughts on the state's response to COVID-19. Are you still happy with the way the state's been responding to this, Dr. Spites?
I am, and I take the opportunity to applaud the governor, and certainly Dr. Nate Smith. I'm a big fan of Dr. Smith. I've known him, well before this ever started, and I think he does a great job. I think it's a loss for the state that I'm happy for him. I'm happy for his family that he's gotten this position with the CDC, but it's certainly going to be a loss for the state of Arkansas. Now, we've got great people that can step up and help fill that void, but. He was certainly a big asset for us. So I think the state's done a good job. I think that we're entering into an interesting time. where, and I kind of expect this as well, you're going to see different areas of the state that undergo different amounts of spread and cases at different times. Early on, I was asked, when do you think it's going to hit the state of Arkansas? And at that time, I said, we'll probably see it in Little Rock first, and then it'll hit Northwest Arkansas, and then it'll come to Northeast Arkansas and kind of spread based on population densities. And that's what happened. And what we're seeing now is certainly Northwest Arkansas, they've seen a significant increase in cases recently. As a matter of fact, just at the last governor's press conference, about 65% of the new cases came from Northwest Arkansas, with only about 9% coming from Northeast Arkansas. So the question is going to come up, is it a one-size-fits-all approach, or are we going to have to take more, as the governor's used this phrase before, a targeted approach at these different areas? I think we may end up doing that. Tennessee did that in the beginning, and I think that's a smart move to be able to say, this area needs to do this, and this area needs to do this differently. And so that may be something that we hear more about in the coming weeks and coming months. Certainly, I could see that being something that we need to have a broader discussion about in the fall as we deal with cases late 2020.
And why is that, that certain parts of the state will get hit harder than others? Because for a while, Northwest Arkansas, there was nothing. Northeast Arkansas, we had an increase in cases, and now it's almost like it's flipped a little bit. There's some areas that are seeing a steady, and then it goes down. Why is that it hits the different part of the states differently, I guess?
It's really based on, this has to do with just population movement and population decisions. And what I mean by that is you'll have, if I go to the store and nobody's wearing masks, well, then I feel kind of strange. Why would I wear a mask? And then all of a sudden cases go up and everybody's wearing a mask. Well, I don't have a mask. I should probably get a mask and wear a mask. I mean, so there's some of that that goes back and forth in terms of the psychology of the spread of the disease. And I think we'll keep seeing that. You'll see these ups and downs. That's kind of what I alluded to earlier in terms of this summer, is we'll have outbreaks. You'll have outbreaks based on events, based on certain things that occur in certain areas. And then they'll go back down and people will get relaxed in their social distancing and their mask wearing. And then cases will go back up and they'll go back to wearing them again. And so I think that's what we're seeing, which is why I think that if you talk about targeted approaches in certain areas, an area that's having few to no cases because the population is doing a great job adhering to the recommendations, maybe they should be afforded a little more opportunity if they're doing the right thing versus different areas who have kind of thrown caution to the wind. Like I said, I think it's going to be a bigger conversation this fall when schools are back in session.
Yeah, that could definitely be a challenging time. One thing that I've been really concerned about is our Latino friends, our friends in the Latino community who are experiencing a very hard time right now. It seems like COVID-19 is really increasing there. Why is that? Are there certain factors that might lead to that, if you don't mind, please? And how can we help out that community?
Some of this is based on, where they're employed in terms of areas. They may, from a communal standpoint, more of them may work in a certain area and within a certain sector. One of the things that I think is great about the Hispanic community, they're very family oriented, which I think is phenomenal. And you'll have multiple families that will gather. And unfortunately, in times like this, the virus can spread. We're hitting, I think the last numbers I saw were about 17% of the Hispanic population were in terms of the cases. But it is concerning, certainly as we see a growing number there. But I think it's just something we have to take into consideration. A lot of the new cases, I think we had about a 50% of the new cases had a Spanish surname, if I remember the information from the governor's press conference most recently. So I think it goes down to education. I really do. I think it's important for us. And sometimes, it's not, always easy to connect with different ethnic populations. But I think education is the key in terms of just the basics. This is how the virus spreads. This is how you can protect yourself. This is how you can protect your family.
Let's go ahead and start asking some questions that were submitted on Facebook. John asked this question. It's not meant to be a political question, but it's a health one. In your view, how does President Trump's decision to leave the World Health Organization affect the response to the pandemic? Once again, it's not political. It's just asking purely on a health standard.
You know, I think certainly during a global crisis, I think the more voices and the more people you have around a table discussing the issues, discussing the problems, discussing how to address them, just from my personal opinion, I think it's a better idea to have more people around the table looking at solutions. When you limit the number of people that are involved in decision making, you risk groupthink. You risk creating an insular scenario where you're missing pieces of information that might change your decision one way or the other. So when we talk about really what's going on a global standpoint, and here in our country, more information, more good information is better than excluding it. And so I'd probably leave it at that and say that, you know, we need to be erring on the side of collaboration and partnership.
Brittany wanted me to ask this question. She knows some people who live in the New Orleans area. We here in Arkansas may not be affected by hurricanes and those kinds of things, except for when you may have a tropical, storm that may come through after it's been a hurricane. But for people who live in that area, because we do have some listeners who will listen on the KASU app or other areas where they still listen, but they may be more in hurricane zones. That has to be a concern, I would think, about people who are preparing or if they're trying to recover from a hurricane or from any kind of weather event and then have to contend with COVID-19. Would you mind addressing that for Brittany, please?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we saw this firsthand when the tornado hit Jonesboro, and there was concern there as we, in terms of the first responders and just the good neighbors who got out and helped each other after that in terms of the cleanup and just making sure everybody was safe. When you look back at the data, I think we did see a rise in the number of cases. However, it was not a spike. It was not what I would consider a significant increase. It would have been more of a, okay, this is probably not surprising given the event that happened. It wouldn't surprise me to see the same from a hurricane. Anytime that you've got, rising floodwaters, things that force people out of their homes or force them into maybe shelter-like scenarios, there's going to be a spread of the virus. I think that's, again, just underscores the need for the mask wearing, the hand washing, and to try to protect yourself and to maintain 6 feet or more, away when you can. It's not when we put these guidelines out and when the CDC puts these guidelines out, I think everybody recognizes that there are times you can't do it. There are times where it's just not feasible. And so you do the best that you can. And so you talk about your overall individual relative risk. And I think I used this analogy once before. It's risky for me to get in my car and drive to campus, but I can reduce my risk by wearing my seatbelt, and I reduce my risk by driving the speed limit, and I reduce my risk by making sure I follow all the traffic laws and the traffic signals. And so there is risk involved with things that we just spoke about in terms of natural disasters and events that would not allow you to social distance. It's just, it goes back to what can you do to reduce your risk from a relative standpoint.
This question just came in as Mary wanted me to ask you this. This has to do with education, with maybe school coming back. Do you expect administrators like superintendents of public schools and them to be able to work with health officials or with our area hospitals to get prepared as students go back to school? How do you think they'll be able to devise some sort of a plan to prepare for something like that? Because if you have a bunch of kids who get sick in school, that could lead to a problem, if you know what Mary's trying to ask.
No, absolutely. And I'm actually glad that came up. It gives me the opportunity to say that I was proud that several of our Northeast Arkansas superintendents actually reached out to me several weeks ago and asked me to present on COVID-19 and to talk about some strategies on how they could prepare for the fall. So this is an ongoing discussion that I know several, quite a few of our superintendents that I spoke to are already having. And we at NYIT are partnering with them to be able to provide that information and provide that guidance and talk about really what's feasible and what's not. I mean, I think everybody kind of rolled their eyes when the guidance came out about the school children, you know, on the bus, you had to sit every other seat and it has to be just one student per seat. Well, that's not feasible. It's just not that we can't do that. We can't, school districts can't implement that. So what are the things that we can do based on our limitations and our resources to keep our kids safe and to keep our staff and our teachers safe? And so those, we're having those conversations with area superintendents. We're hoping that through our Delta Population Health Institute and through our main campus at NYIT, we can create some resources and some videos and be able to provide feedback. It'll be different though. I think, probably the elementary school classroom will look pretty similar, but the high school classroom won't. I think that, you know, students going from class to class all day long, I would be surprised if we continue to do that. I think you may have cohorts of students that are in class with each other all day long, much like you see in the elementary schools. There will be changes. There will be changes to, you know, what band looks like and what football looks like and you know, cheerleading practice and soccer practice. So those are all discussions we'll be having and the school districts will be having and trying to figure out the best way to approach that. We do expect the Arkansas Department of Education to put some things out here probably within the next month, some more specific guidance. We do expect to see more from the CDC. They put some things out as well. And then to sit down then and look at how each school district can basically interpret that and have it fit their needs. There's some work to be done for sure before school starts back in August.
Do you expect students to be all wearing masks and those kinds of things or face coverings when they go back to school, do you think? And this could even go to maybe like college students as well. Like anyone who's going to school in the fall, do you think everyone will be wearing masks?
Oh, I do. I know we've ordered well over 1,000 masks just for NYITCOM, just for students, staff, and faculty. And we will have the expectation that they are wearing those masks on campus, in public areas, in our hallways. That's just going to be an expectation. I believe that ASU will be doing something similar. I don't know that for a fact, but we're still having those discussions with them. I do believe that you'll see that in K-12. Now, how do you keep a five-year-old, a six-year-old to wear a mask? Some of these things, it's just, again, it goes back to what's really feasible and what's really possible. I think that, and I want the public to recognize this too, right now our frontline fighters, you know, nurses, physicians, respiratory therapists, lab techs, our hospital, staff are really front lines of this. Our educators will become more frontline this fall. The faculty in the college classrooms, the kindergarten teacher, the sixth grade teacher, the counselors, the school nurses. I mean, those are the individuals that are going to be literally face to face with this starting in August. And I think that's going to be something we're going to have to just recognize as well.
Jerry wanted me to ask you this question. You know, obviously the nation is still dealing with this horrendous death of George Floyd. And there's been a lot of protests that have been taking place. Peaceful protests have been going on. So he wanted me to ask you about, you worry about an increased number of cases during the peaceful protests that have been going on and taking place after the horrendous death of George Floyd.
So a couple of things on that. I think one of the things that goes, that's of a benefit or that kind of goes in favor of a reduced number of cases is the fact that these protests take place outside. And we know that being outside with constant air movement and that there's a reduction of the spread of the virus that way. We know that really your highest risk is in an enclosed room or space with limited airflow and a large number of people. So that's the highest risk. However, there obviously is still increased risk when you gather together in such close proximity. The videos that I've been seeing largely, even locally and around the country, there are a large number of people wearing masks. I think that's great. So the fact that you're outside, you're wearing a mask helps. One of the things that should be remembered is there's a large number of middle-aged or younger individuals involved in this. Remember, those are more likely your asymptomatic spreaders. They may not have symptoms, but they may go back home and spread it to somebody who's more vulnerable. I don't see a lot of hand washing or that sort of thing that may be going on. So I can't speak to that in terms of maybe they would, and maybe they carried alcohol-based hand sanitizer in their pocket or back at their vehicles. It would not surprise me to see an increase in cases, certainly in these areas where you had large protests and the individuals were in very close proximity for a long amount of time. So being close together for, 15 minutes versus being close together for 3 hours is different. The longer you're closer with each other, the more likely the virus is going to spread from person to person. Like I said, the saving grace is that the vast, vast majority that I've seen are all occur outside, and a large number of individuals are wearing masks. So I think that goes, that could be helpful in some sense. But again, would not surprise me at all to see an increase in cases. And when would we see those? And people always ask about that too. Probably within 4 weeks or so. And so that's kind of a sweet spot, I would say. This is not something you say, okay, if we don't have any increased cases in 14 days, we're good. No, that's not really the way it works. Just because of the way that the virus can shed and replicate, I would say 4 weeks. I'd say anywhere between 2 to 6 weeks is when you'll really see if there were cases associated with these protests.
Here's another question on Facebook. How long do you think we'll be in phase one? It's a two-part question. I'm sorry. So let me just go into it. How long do you think we'll be in phase one? And what's the criteria that must be reached to go to phase two?
So I'll be honest with you. I can't read the governor's mind on phase one to phase two. I will say that just based on some of the speech that he's given and based on my interpretation of the data, I would be surprised if we move to phase two anytime soon. I don't know that you'll move to phase two with cases going up in the state of Arkansas. That would surprise me. But in terms of what does it take to go from one phase to the next, the White House information, when they put that out, they have that proposed gating criteria. And it's actually required that when you go from one phase to the next, you go back through the gating criteria. And so that gating criteria, it looks at three things. It looks at symptoms, it looks at number of cases, and it looks at the hospitals in terms of what their capacity is. And so there's about six different things there that you have to look at. On the symptom side, it's a downward trajectory of influenza-like illness within a 14-day period and a downward trajectory of COVID-like symptoms within a 14-day period. In terms of the cases, it's a downward trajectory of documented cases within a 14-day period or a downward trajectory of positive tests as a percent of the total tests within a 14-day period. And then in terms of hospitals, you want to make sure that your resources are in place, that they have the capacity to manage and treat these, and they have what's termed as robust testing program. So that is the gating criteria. And so to go for us to enter in, to go from phase one to phase two, we have to meet that gating criteria. We don't meet it right now because of our trajectory on cases. So I would be surprised. Now, it's completely up to the governor because this gating criteria is, these are just recommendations, and it's up to each state on how they want to manage it. But again, he's done a good job of pretty much following most of these recommendations from the CDC, as well as what Dr. Fauci has put out and the gating criteria that from the White House. So I don't see us doing that in the face of increased cases. This kind of goes back to the comment that was mentioned earlier. Well, what if one area of the state meets the criteria and the other one doesn't? That's an interesting idea. That kind of goes back to more of a targeted approach. I think that's probably a larger discussion. It wouldn't surprise me if that comes up. But right now, that's kind of where we stand in terms of our movement to phase two.
Ed asked this question. There was a lot of talk about, the Spanish flu, 1918 pandemic and that. Have you all been able to use any information from that particular pandemic to help deal with this particular pandemic? So what did you learn from the last pandemic to be able to help in the addressing of this particular pandemic with COVID-19?
So, I'll say this, it's kind of a mixed bag. It was helpful and it's not. And it's not in terms of it's a completely different virus. It's a completely different virus. And so you can't, and so in terms of spread, I mean, there were some things that were similar. Now, one of the things it did help us look at was basically a pandemic. You know, so regardless of what virus it is, how does a pandemic work? And I think that's really one of the biggest things you heard early on, and we still make a big deal about, is the flattening of the curve. That came from the 1918 Spanish influenza, where basically you had, and you may have heard this before, a tale of two cities, where you had Philadelphia and you had St. Louis that had two different completely approaches to it. One of them shut down. Basically was able to flatten the curve and flatten the number of cases and basically maintained their resource ability within their healthcare system. And the other one didn't. The other one had a large outdoor parade. It was actually Philadelphia. It had a large outdoor parade and hundreds of thousands of people were involved. And they saw a huge spike and it overwhelmed their system. And they had a much higher number of deaths because when you have to ration healthcare resources, then people suffer. And so that's what they saw there. So that's, I would say that's probably the biggest takeaway that we had from the 1918 Spanish influenza. I think a lot of people also looked at what happens when you have a new virus that comes up at that seasonal time. So it hit about the spring, it smoldered in the summertime, they saw a few ups and downs, and then it came back and it was much more significant in the fall with much higher number of infections and deaths than they saw in the spring. I think that's the concern. I think when you hear and listen to more and more infectious disease specialists and epidemiologists that are looking, I think that's why there's kind of an alarm saying, look, we've seen this in the past with a pandemic, we should be on guard and we should be preparing for it now.
What do you think we can do to be better prepared over the next year to several years for the next pandemic threat? You know, we know that it's not a matter of if another one's coming, it's just a matter of when. What can we do to be better prepared for the next time?
You know, we actually had some of this discussion in the 2009 H1N1 influenza, swine flu influenza pandemic, where we came out with lots of different ways to have an approach to testing, to isolation, to management of resources. And so we kind of pulled that book off the shelf when this started this last spring. Hands down, there are lessons learned. There's a lot of interesting research going on too, though, that's saying, okay, did this really work? There was a great article that came out. There's some research going on out of New York right now in terms of, okay, did the wearing masks work? Does social distancing work? Does washing hands work? And so we're going to see a volume of research articles come out in the next several years that I think will truly help us prepare for that next pandemic. I think we'll create platforms. I think there's a lot of things we were kind of knocked back on our heels on in terms of, you know, really creating a brand new vaccine and really creating a new testing platform. So the three things that, you know, the tracing, even the contact tracing, we've struggled in several areas that I think we're learning a lot in, and ideally we're able to fix a lot of this so the next time we see it, we've got a much better system in place to handle it. And so the big four areas that I would say that we're going to probably excel in would be testing, tracing, preparation of hospital resources and surge capacity, vaccines, and being able to basically readily get a vaccine available. And then, of course, medications in terms of being able to rapidly identify an ability to get something out there. And we've done a decent job on that. We're not anywhere where we need to be like we are with flu, but, you know, we've done that over a long period of time, over years and years. That's not something we just came up with either. So anyway, I hope that's helpful.
It really is. Thank you so much for your time. We really do appreciate it. We'll be checking back with you here in just a couple of weeks. But Dr. Shane Spites is the dean of the NYIT College of Osteopathic Medicine at Arkansas State University. Thank you so much for joining us here today for COVID-19 questions and answers. We appreciate you.
Thank you, Jonathan. I appreciate you. Appreciate your listeners. And just thank you guys for helping get good information out.
And we do want to remind you that you can go back and you can listen to this interview at any time. You can go to KASU.org and you can look for the coronavirus page where we got the very latest information. We have that for you there on the coronavirus page. That'll be up for you to be able to listen back to the interview at any time. You're listening to KASU Jonesboro. I'm Jonathan Reeves. Thank you so much for listening. Arkansas Roots is next.